This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel, and in this part of the program, we recall a man responsible for a work that is a staple of the holiday season. His name used to be hugely famous, but nowadays it draws blank stares, even from people who know his work. E.T.A. Hoffmann, born 1776, died 1822 in the Kingdom of Prussia. I came across the name recently in Matthew Guerrieri's new book, The First Four Notes. The book is about Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, and as Guerrieri writes, one of the most influential reviews of that work was written by E.T.A. Hoffmann in 1810, not long after the symphony was first performed.
It was really both the first extended review of the Fifth Symphony that we have, and it was also really this one particular review that is the bridge between Beethoven as a composer of the classical era and Beethoven as this sort of almost musical mascot of the German Romantic movement, which became really one of the most long-lasting and persistent images of Beethoven that we have.
One of the most striking things about this review is, it's of course by Ernst Theodor Amadeus Hoffmann, and Hoffmann had not heard Beethoven's Fifth.
At this time, no, he hadn't. He had the score in front of him, so essentially it's a review of the score. It says he had just gotten it, it had just been published.
It was also arranged for a piano for four hands, so that gave him some assist in understanding what it sounded like, but he was applying quite a musical head to this task to be able to write about a symphony without actually hearing it.
Yes, it's a feat of imagination in a lot of ways, but it would have been standard for the time. It also explains why it's a review much more about the nuts and bolts of the piece of music than how it actually would be experienced in a concert hall. And I think it's one of the reasons that he's able to, in the review, talk about the experience of it in a language and in a manner that's far more heightened than we would ever really experience.
Before Hoffmann gets into what, as you say, amounts like a play-by-play of the symphony, he wrote this: "Music reveals an unknown kingdom to mankind, a world that has nothing in common with the outward material world that surrounds it, and in which we leave behind all predetermined conceptual feelings in order to give ourselves up to the inexpressible."
And that's representative of the language he uses throughout. And to our ears, that sounds very, very esoteric and very high-flown, but what the Romantics were really trying to do, and Hoffmann was very much a member in good standing of the German Romantic movement, they had this problem of trying to put into language how it is we experience beauty.
Hoffmann was actually named Ernst Theodor Wilhelm Hoffmann, but he changed the Wilhelm to Amadeus out of admiration for Mozart. And he didn't just write about music. He composed music. He also drew. He painted. And here's the connection to this time of year. Hoffmann wrote stories, spooky tales that trespassed the border between fantasy and reality. They were such famous stories, other composers read them throughout the 19th century and set them to music. For example, Jacques Offenbach's opera, Tales of Hoffmann. One of the episodes in Tales of Hoffmann was based on a story called The Sandman, in which evil inventors create a robotic girl. It was loosely the basis for Leo Delibes' ballet, Coppelia. In many of Hoffmann's stories, inanimate things come to life. He was a champion of the imagination run wild. Jack Zipes, a retired professor of German and comparative literature at the University of Minnesota, says Hoffmann was rebelling against the dominant movement of his time, the Enlightenment, with its emphasis on rational philosophy.
He believed strongly, as most of the German Romantics at that time, that the imagination was being attacked by the rise of rationalism in Germany or in German-speaking countries or throughout Europe, and that the only way that an artist could survive would be to totally become dedicated to another way of looking at the world and reclaiming nature, reclaiming innocence, reclaiming an authentic way of living and not conceding anything to the rise of rationalism in society at that time.
One of Hoffman's stories was about a little girl, Marie, and her Christmas toys. Hoffman's title for it was Nutcracker and Mouse King. In his original version, a beautiful nutcracker gets broken. At night, Marie goes to check up on him, and he's come alive. A story within a story begins. Armies of mice and toy soldiers battle in what is either the child's delirious nightmare or perhaps another reality into which she has wandered. The French writer Alexandre Dumas adapted the story, altered the original. He made it lighter and less scary. And in 1892, a team of Russians turned that story into a ballet. The ballet, The Nutcracker, did not enjoy great success at first, but the music by Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky eventually did, and staging it has become a Christmas season ritual. Something fundamental happened to Hoffman's story in this progression from dark to light. Marie became Clara. The young girl's flights of imagination became sweeter and more tame. Her family, they're called Silberhaus, German for silver house in the ballet, also became sweeter. Again, Jack Zipes.
The family in his story, in contrast to the ballet, is called Stahlbaum, which means steel tree. And the Clara, who is the protagonist of Hoffman's story, a young girl of about 7, 8, or 9, is imprisoned within the regulations of the family. The family follows rituals in a prescribed way, and she feels somewhat constrained by this, and it's not until this very weird, provocative godfather by the name of Drosselmeyer. It's very difficult to translate the word Drosselmeyer, but it's somebody who stirs things up. And Drosselmeyer certainly shakes things up. He brings these amazing toys that he has made and ignites the imagination of the young people in the celebration of Christmas.
In the 1980s, the Pacific Northwest Ballet wanted to return to the Hoffman version. They asked an illustrator and writer who was famous for his own dark voyages with childhood demons to take a look. Maurice Sendak, who created Where the Wild Things Are.
So when I did read it, I became very interested because it was a very bizarre story. It is a very bizarre story. And that, of course, would appeal to me. It meant something. I mean, it had bite and muscle the way the Grimm fairy tales do. So I thought if we could put up on the stage in Seattle anything approximating Hoffman without diluting or bashing Tchaikovsky, then perhaps we would have something that was interesting.
Maurice Sendak died this year. That was from a 1984 NPR interview. He published a Nutcracker book that year. His version of the ballet, with his sets and libretto, is the only Nutcracker that Professor Jack Zipes says captures the spirit of Hoffman. Now, stories evolve from one author to another and one medium to another, but Jack Zipes says that what's been lost from the Nutcracker in most productions is Hoffman's very attitude toward imagination, reality, and childhood.
There is a great deal of damage done to Hoffman's story because at the end of his story, Marie moves off into another world, or it seems that she's going off into another world, a world of her own choosing, whereas in the ballet, it's a harmless diversion that is full of sort of dancing and merriment. But there's nothing profound in the ending of the ballet as it exists. And it's also true of Dumas' story, ends in a very fluffy, saccharine way. Whereas Hoffman wanted to make sure that Marie is shown to be aware of the fact that there is a contrast between the reality in which she's living and the world to which she's going, which is a world of her imagination, a world of her choice, where she can also make decisions that are more in accord with her own imagination and more in accord with her own creativity.
Reading the Hoffman story of the Nutcracker and the Mouse King, And thinking of the ballet, it reminded me of The Wizard of Oz, actually, in which a young girl has what she thinks is a real experience, but actually she's been dreaming and she's been delirious. And in the end, the message is there's no place like home. In the end of the Hoffman story, there's no place like getting away from home. There's no place like breaking loose from this reality.
Right. Well, the MGM movie of The Wizard of Oz also ruined L. Frank Baum's The Wizard of Oz because he went on to write 13 more stories, and Dorothy eventually leaves Kansas forever and lives in Oz. And the same thing happens in Tchaikovsky's version of the Nutcracker because of the fact that Maria makes a concession to reality and gives in. But nevertheless, one of the interesting things about Sendak is that he said that the music retains Hoffman's spirit, and it's that which he tried to change in his version. He saw in the music itself something that excited him, something that really touched upon the essence of the Hoffman story. And it's this essence is in almost all of Hoffman's fairy tales. And essentially, it's that we have to keep in touch with the child within us.
By the way, E.T.A. Hoffman challenged his readers to liberate their inner child from the routines of lives led in deference to the rational real world. But he was no bohemian in his own life. He was trained as a lawyer and worked as a judge. His art couldn't pay the bills. E.T.A. Hoffman was a towering figure after his death in 1822 for the rest of the 19th century. But Professor Zeib says that fame faded by the end of the century.
And even today, most American intellectuals, American professors of literature have not read Hoffman. And it's a shame because they're very relevant to our own society today, where the imagination is being deteriorated throughout our country.
Professor Zeibs, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's Jack Zeibs talking about the life and work of writer, composer, and painter E.T.A. Hoffman, whose work inspired the ballet The Nutcracker. We also heard the late Maurice Sendak and writer Matthew Guerrero. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Dick Wolfe has written a novel, a thriller set in New York after the killing of Osama bin Laden. It's called The Intercept. Detective Jeremy Fisk of the NYPD Intel Division is the hero of the story, and Wolfe says there are more Jeremy Fisk stories to come. If his record in television is any indication, there could be dozens of Detective Fisk books. Wolf is the man who created the Law and Order shows. He says these days, all of the shows run or rerun an average of 109 times a week. One secret to the franchise's longevity, Wolf says, only partly facetiously, I think, was how many of the shows aired originally at 10 p.m.
The reason it repeats so well, in my opinion, is because half the audience has fallen asleep and can't remember. How does this end?
it's also your demographic, frankly, that when you get a healthy
chunk
of people...
Now, be careful.
in their 60s, you can show the same show every 6 months.
Endlessly.
No one can remember. So after all these years of shepherding some of the best actors in New York, some of the best writers, after branching out from Law and Order to Law and Order Special Victims Unit, which is still on the air, and Law and Order Criminal Intent, Wolf has taken up the solitary task of writing detective novels. In some ways, it's different.
I'd say the biggest difference is that you don't have 140 other people to depend on. One way to describe it is it's the old dream of, you know, you walk out on stage at your high school and you're completely naked. That, okay, if you didn't like it, I can't blame the DP.
Yeah. It's you. It's you.
This is truly
individual work.
Well, it's, you know, you pays your money and takes your chances because, you hope for a certain type of reaction to the book, and you hope it's not, gee, you should really stay in television.
I am an unabashed Dick Wolf fan. I loved the original Law & Order, even if it was predictable. At some point, it did occur to me that a 10:20 p.m. suspect was just too early. You know, that just could not be the guy, because
I'll tell you one very amusing story, because prosecutors would reference Law & Order all the time. This isn't Law & Order. You're not necessarily going to get forensic evidence presented to you the way they do on television. But my favorite was a defense attorney who got up and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the police arrested my client 4 hours after the crime, and as you all know from watching Law & Order, the first person they arrest is never guilty. They didn't even investigate anybody else."
This is the second commercial break defense.
That's right. He was convicted.
Dick Wolf's novel is suspenseful, and it's reminiscent of his shows, which for fans like me have been the best stuff on network TV. Wolf says the book picks up where a Law & Order project left off on 9/11.
I was in New York with the shooting crew. We were 2 weeks away from beginning principal photography on a miniseries called Terror, which started in an Al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan with a class of 10-year-olds with their fists up saying, "God is great, death to America." The brother of one of them coming in, who was about 20, to say goodbye because he was going to America to become a great hero. Cut to the brother in a car with three other guys going to the city, blowing up a bomb under the shuttle in Times Square, killing 2,500 people, and then releasing anthrax. Needless to say, when the planes went in, we pulled the plug.
So while writing a detective novel marks a big change for Dick Wolf, it's very much connected to his TV work and to his style.
I have five kids, and the 25-year-old read the book about 3 or 4 months ago and came in and said, "Pretty good, Dad, but it reads an awful lot like a script." I said, "Thank you."
So here's what an old friend of mine who wrote a lot of scripts for you told me. He said, a script for Dick Wolf in Law & Order for an hour of television is like 10 pages longer than anybody else's script for an hour of television, because it's wall-to-wall words. It's all in there.
Not much action. We didn't do car chases.
No car chases. Not a lot of times cruising around the city getting from place
exactly.
to place. People talking.
When the words are good, that's really all you need. I've said for many, many years, and I gave to the heads of the networks, this is about 15 years ago, little leather desk cards that said, "It's the writing, stupid." And it's always the writing.
So when you sit down to write a novel, as opposed to a script, you can't count on the expression of Jerry Orbach telling us what he's feeling at that moment. You've got to now describe people's feelings, and you have to describe all sorts of inner dialogues that don't figure in a script.
Well, it's certainly a different rhythm. I mean, the novel is about six times as long as any television script. So I grew up, and I hate to even say literary, because I consider this not literature, but a thriller, which has been one of my favorite forms since I was 10 years old. Sherlock Holmes is probably my greatest influence growing up. So, I think it's a very legitimate form of writing. It may not be the most elevated, but it's sure is fun. I've told a bunch of people that I've given the book to, wait till you've got a nice long flight to New York or you're going to Europe. It's a great airplane book. And I try to keep literary pretensions at arm's reach and tell people I think it's a good story, and it's kind of scary because virtually everything in there is, as far as I can tell and as far as some of the people who have vetted the book, completely accurate.
Now, I enjoyed it tremendously. And
well, thank you.
I have no idea if your recipes for explosives are accurate or too accurate. I will say that, you know, I will quibble with you and make one one critical comment. One of the scariest things in the book, from my experience as a native New Yorker, was traffic driving uptown on 2nd Avenue, which I think is
Well,
that's terrifying, since it is a one-way street coming downtown.
It is.
Yeah.
Look, there are so many details that I was afraid of getting wrong that the book passes muster with the people that I was most concerned would go, oh, this is this isn't realistic on any level. I think it's pretty realistic.
Yeah, and I forgive you the 2nd Avenue thing.
I know. It's, I don't. I've been out of the city. I don't. But don't forget, when I was growing up, it was two-way. So
there are going to be more Detective Jeremy Fisk NYPD intel.
Oh yeah. The second one is in progress, and the second one is about narco terrorism, which is a major threat to us now.
So this is a true career change here that you're making. I mean, you're going to hang in there with this.
I'm going to try. I mean, look, I've had a tremendous time. I've met new people. It's a completely different world, and I wouldn't say it's a new career direction. I would hope it would be a career enhancement that allows me to tell some stories on a bigger canvas, and if I can come up with the right stories, I think that he is as effective a lead in a novel as Jack Ryan. I'm not trying to be presumptuous, but that's a pretty good model to follow.
Well, Dick Wolf, thank you very much for talking with us, first of all, about your new and first novel, The Intercept, and for talking about and for providing us with so many years of Law and Order.
Well, thank you. This was fun.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You might be stocking up on champagne for New Year's Eve, but this morning we're going to offer you an alternative. Doesn't this all get you in the mood for a cocktail party? Well, author Leslie Bloom wants to revive the cocktail culture of Mad Men days and even earlier eras. In her book, Let's Bring Back the Cocktail Edition, Bloom urges a comeback for such elegant libations as the Parisian.
It's one of these really old-fashioned drinks that you never see made anymore, and ingredients are layered. Each ingredient is added from the densest to the least dense. It's so beautiful. You know, it's in a clear bell-shaped glass, and you sip it with either a sterling silver or a gold straw, one liqueur at a time.
Bloom's book includes the stories behind the drinks and tips on how and when to serve them.
What my book really chronicles is genuinely lost cocktails and cocktail culture from bygone eras. So we have 144 cocktails that you just probably wouldn't see on bar menus or being served at home cocktail parties today. Really quite obscure but delicious and delightful stuff.
So it's not so much that the whole culture is fading, it's that you want to bring back some of these secret oldies that just don't show up that often anymore.
Exactly. And also, I mean, I'm not a bartender, I'm a historian. And so when I came to this topic, I started researching in historical archives for cocktails. One of the things that I uncovered was how mischievous and amusing a lot of cocktail history was. And I feel like a lot of contemporary cocktail culture has gotten a bit self-serious. And one of the things that resonated with me was how unself-serious cocktail culture was in bygone eras. I would say 99% of the cocktails that we selected for this book really are impish and outrageous, and they're portals into social history.
You know, it's funny you say that. When I've gone into some of these newish cocktail bars in some cities, it feels very serious. It's like some of the bartenders are not smiling. They're shaking the shaker like with a lot of force, and they look so serious. I mean, you're saying that's not the way it used to be?
Some bartenders were famous for a particular kind of gravitas, like the original father of mixology, who was known as Professor Jerry Thomas, although he's not really, it's never been confirmed that he held any kind of advanced degree. He was a serious bartender in the age of whiskey slingers in, you know, the 1800s in San Francisco. And, you know, he had a starched white shirt with diamond cufflinks and a silver bar set, which he toured in Europe with. And he really elevated the art of mixology, but for the most part, a lot of bartenders were determined to create really delicious drinks, but there was a culture of hilarity that surrounded drink making. I really wanted to celebrate that in this book.
Well, you know, the names of the cocktails throughout this book, a lot of fun. One of them, Death in the Afternoon.
Love Death in the Afternoon. It was supposedly a Hemingway invention, which he named after his famous book about bullfighting. And in a recipe drafted by the famous author, he instructs readers to, quote, pour one jigger of absinthe into a champagne glass. Add iced champagne until it attains the proper opalescent milkiness. And then he adds, drink 3 to 5 of these slowly. So you can see why these drinks were called Death in the Afternoon. I mean, 3 to 5 of these drinks would likely do most of us modern drinkers in.
Yeah, that would take care of me. What is your general advice to people who are hearing this and are thinking about throwing a party, you know, in this holiday season and are like, wow, I could you know, try one, you know, a new cocktail or two?
You know, choosing a cocktail for a party, I mean, there are a couple of different ways to go about it. So perhaps you pick a theme. So like for Halloween, for example, maybe you pick, you know, the Corpse Reviver or the Zombie Punch. Or maybe you tailor the drink to the guest of honor of the party in an amusing way. So let's say you're throwing a bridal shower. Why not serve the demure maiden's blush cocktail? And then, you know, for the holidays, I love the idea of reviving the gin fizz. A very basic version of the gin fizz contains gin, simple syrup, which is sugar water, lemon juice, and egg white. You shake it with ice, and then you pour it into a champagne coupe or a cocktail glass, and you top it off with seltzer. And it's really effervescent and velvety. Except for the holidays, I recommend that you top it off with champagne instead of seltzer. And then that officially changes the category of gin fizz to a diamond fizz.
Oh.
And, you know, what could be more glamorous or celebratory than a diamond fizz?
Any other tips that you can offer for if you really want to gussy up a party with presentation?
Well, for me, I'm looking at everything through sort of a vintage prism. One of the things I really love about vintage cocktail culture was that there was often such an element of high presentation involved. Like vintage barware and glassware often got so creative and so delightful. You can find it really easily at garage sales or eBay today. It's really fun to serve vintage cocktails in vintage glassware. And, you know, back in the day, there was a great fanfare involved with serving cocktails. For me, the old-fashioned champagne tower, for instance, makes that point really nicely.
Champagne tower. What's that?
So popular in the 1920s, these towers were basically a pyramid of champagne coupe glasses, you know, the round glasses as opposed to the flutes.
Uh-huh.
And champagne was poured into the top glass and it trickled down into all the glasses below. So instead of being handed a common old flute of champagne by a sullen waiter when you walk into the room,
right.
You got to, you know, prance up to this tower and you pluck a coupe of champagne off of this golden, glimmering affair.
And I hope you didn't knock the whole thing over, I guess.
I'm sure that happened quite frequently with, you know, later in the evening when these drunks would stagger over to it, hands extended. But,
yeah.
You know, at least in the beginning of the party, it sets the tone of the party really beautifully.
Well, so we couldn't have this conversation without making a drink, but there were a couple of rules we had to follow. I mean, we couldn't light a match inside a radio studio. And...
Well, that actually omits half of the recipes in my book, since they all are very pyrotechnic.
Yeah, and also my skills are a little limited, but we came up with the Godmother, and I think I have the ingredients here in front of me.
That's a good one. I profile the Godmother cocktail as part of one of my inseparable combination series. The Godmother obviously goes hand in hand with the vintage Godfather cocktail.
Of course. The
Godmother cocktail is 1 ounce of vodka, 1 ounce of amaretto,
yep.
And you stir it with ice.
All right. Well, I have some ice. I have a plastic shaker here. We've got the vodka. We've got a bottle of amaretto. So I just mix it up and strain into a cup, right?
Yep. This is not a shaken cocktail
for
whatever reason.
All right. I'm stirring here.
Stirring it with ice. Make sure, you know, give it a good stir so the liquid ends up being of a uniform temperature.
Got it.
And then I assume that you don't have a chilled cocktail glass unless you've gotten very fancy in the studio.
Sadly, I just have a paper coffee cup. But I hope presentation is not good here.
Well, we can't see it, so we'll just imagine that you're pouring it into a chilled cocktail glass. And then you drink it up. And for me, I always like to imagine the inspiration behind the cocktail, you know, as I'm drinking it. So we suggest that you serve this particular cocktail with a list of wishes to be granted by a godmother.
Oh, that's nice. Okay, so I'm pouring this into my cup here. And I should be making a wish?
Yes. Well, you can have a whole list of wishes. Just imagine that your godmother is there to grant them.
Okay, imagine. I'm going to take a taste here. Oh, that's really good.
Good.
It's going to make this day very interesting. Leslie Bloom, cheers to you.
And to you as well.
Thank you. She's the author of Let's Bring Back the Cocktail Edition.
Thank you. It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. The Bush family of St. Louis is about as close to royalty as it gets in that city. For nearly 150 years, the beer they produced, Budweiser, was known as the king of beers. But the story of the Bush family reads almost like a Shakespearean drama, full of intrigue, betrayal, and eventually collapse. Bill Niedelsater tells that story in his new book about the family. It's called Bitter Brew. And in it, he traces the origins of Anheuser-Busch back to the middle of the 19th century and its founder, a young German emigre named Adolphus Busch.
He was an 18-year-old German immigrant from a large family in Germany, one of 22 children. He arrived in St. Louis in 1857. He stepped off a steamboat and took the first steps toward building what would be the world's largest brewery. At the time, there were 40 breweries in St. Louis.
40 in St. Louis?
40 in St. Louis. That's kind of how it was.
And St. Louis was a particularly German city.
And they did what they knew how to do. They built breweries. At the time, America was a whiskey-drinking country, and they built breweries to satisfy the thirst of those people.
So here you have this young man. He's in St. Louis. He knows how to brew beer. He's got a little bit of money, and as you write, he buys a brewery supply business first.
Right, and he supplies one very bad brewery called the Bavarian Brewery, which was owned by Anheuser, who was a soap manufacturer who had acquired it, the brewery, in a defaulted debt. And he was not a brewer, and he had this brewery there that made terrible-tasting beer. And, you know, the people would spit it back across the bar, you know, at the bartenders. And he married Anheuser's daughter, and Anheuser sort of brought him in. Anheuser had built up a debt to him. So he, in exchange for Busch forgiving the debt that he owed for supplies and stuff like that, he cut him in with shares. Adolphus proved to be a very smart salesman, very good salesman, and he sort of took over the running of the brewery, and the rest is history.
I mean, that became Anheuser-Busch.
Well, that became Anheuser-Busch. One of the first things he did was get a good recipe for beer, which he acquired through a friend from some monks that made this particular beer in Bohemia, in this region called Budweis. And he then proceeded to outthink everybody else. At the time, you brewed beer, it was all consumed locally. I mean, the brewing industry is almost hyper-local. It was by neighborhood, because you couldn't store beer very long. And he read about the pasteurization of wine and thought, I bet you could do that with beer. And he was the first person to pasteurize beer so that he could store it longer, he could put it on railroad cars. He thereby built the first national brand of beer. He figured out that, well, you know, I should own the company that builds the railroad cars. I should own the company that makes the bottles that we're putting it in. He bought a couple coal mines on the other side of the river from St. Louis that would fire his plant. And he was vertically integrated before there was a name for it.
This company was run by five generations of Bushes, starting with Adolphus. And as anyone who reads your book will discover, it reads like a Shakespearean tale, a pretty unbelievably scandalous stories throughout this book. But I want to start by asking about his son, August Anheuser. He was the guy who kind of really made this company explode.
He saved the company. He kept the company afloat during, you know, Prohibition, World War I, and the Depression, which is just astonishing that you could do that. Very few others lasted, and their yeast profits saved the company. That was the cash engine that kept the company open during the Depression. He was able to keep 2,000 people working at a time when the brewery industry in St. Louis was wiped out. So when Prohibition ended then, they still had some money. They were in a good position in that all the competition was gone.
His son, one of his sons, known as Gussie, he sort of pushed his older brother aside to take over the company. He became the sort of the legendary dominating figure for the next, half century.
Oh, yeah. He is the beer baron. And he was also a really larger-than-life character, outspoken, crude, coarse, colorful, funny, outrageous, and I think probably the best beer salesman who ever lived. And he basically came out of World War II determined that he was going to put them back on top and they were going to be the number one beer company in the world, and he did that.
Gussie's son, August III, I guess it's an understatement to say, clashed with his father to the point where he basically stages a coup to oust his father and take over the company. What happens?
Well, what happened was is that he wanted to modernize the company, and his father, who was getting old, was fighting against it, and he was an authoritarian, old-school guy, and he didn't believe in corporate planning or computers and all that. He was always, you know, you react fast to things, and you'd get it done, and he went by the seat of his pants. So August the 3rd, as he rose up in the ranks, a very bright guy, was at loggerheads with his father all the time. The 3rd, as that he was referred to, August the 3rd, staged a coup where he convinced the board to vote against his father.
The final sort of chapter to the Bush family and the beer empire is with August Bush the 4th. He is the son of the 3rd. The opening scene in your book actually takes place at the end of that timeline. And he, August Bush the 4th, is late to a meeting. He's supposed to address several hundred Anheuser-Busch distributors. He's late. Eventually he shows up. And what happens?
It's the middle of the afternoon, and he finally shows up after keeping people waiting for a half an hour or so. And he's stoned. He's loaded. He cannot deliver the speech. And he had to be led off the stage, and they'd give some sort of story that he was taking some sort of, you know, cold medication or something like that, you know, which nobody believed. And it was like 3-4 weeks later that the hostile bid for takeover of Anheuser-Busch began.
This is by InBev.
By InBev, a company that had not existed 4 years before.
It's an incredible story. William Nadelsieder's new book is called Bitter Brew. It's about the history of Anheuser-Busch and the Busch family. Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
As 2013 approaches, we're looking back at the best books of 2012. Over the next couple of weekends, we'll be asking authors from four major genres to tell us about their favorite books of the last year. We begin with the best young adult fiction of the year. Maggie Stiefvater is the best-selling author of Shiver Trilogy and The Raven Boys. She recommends young adult fiction for all ages.
I am a voracious reader as well as a writer. I love reading young adult novels, and I actually knew all along that I was going to write young adult because they always say you should write what you've always loved to read, and those are the books that I always picked up off the shelf. My absolute favorite book of the year was Codename Verity, and it is not a fantasy novel. It's actually historical fiction, and it's about two girls who are best friends during World War II. They both live in England, and they're both part of the war effort. One of them is a pilot, and the other one is a spy. And the story begins when one of them is shot down over France and is interrogated. So my favorite character in Codename Verity is actually the girl who is shot down over World War II France. And the thing I love about her is that she's very brave and very spunky, but then when she does break, and invariably she does break, it is heartrending because you can see how strong she is and how much she had to put up with in order to actually be taken down like that. It has a depth of storytelling and character building that I think can appeal to adults, but it also has an overall simplified storyline that goes through this kind of tangled mess of wires that I think even the youngest of readers could appreciate coming into historical fiction. I can't think of anybody on my list that I wouldn't be happy putting this book in the hand of.
Maggie Stiefvater's latest book is The Raven Boys. Her favorite young adult book of 2012 was Codename Verity by Elizabeth Wine. You can see her full list of best books from last year at npr.org.